to the Be Yourself Happy, Healthy, Hopeful podcast. I'm your host, Adriana Grande. I'm a health promoter at the Bulimia Anorexia Nervosa Association, also known as BANA, here in Windsor, Essex. I'm thrilled to be here with you as we begin our journey of meaningful conversations about mental health, self-acceptance, and the path to wellness. Today, I'm joined by Heather LeBlanc, a registered social worker here at BANA. Heather has a joint honors Bachelor of Arts degree in psychology and social development studies with a specialization in individual well-being and development. She specializes in the treatment of eating disorders, disordered eating, and body image. Heather is passionate about working collaboratively with clients to deconstruct harmful health and weight narratives that perpetuate body shame and anti-fat bias. I learned so much from Heather, whether it be about the history of body image, social justice, or ARFID, I'm incredibly grateful to work with her. Thank you for taking time out of your very busy schedule, Heather, to be here with me today.
No problem. Thanks for having me. And thanks for the intro. It was super sweet.
I know. You're the perfect person to talk to today. So I'm so excited to get some of my questions answered as well about ARFID. I feel like when I started at BANA a few years ago, no one really knew what ARFID was. But now when I'm out in the community, everyone's heard of ARFID.
Yeah.
So I'm sure people in the community, will be very interested to hear what you have to say today. Okay, so maybe before we get into the details of ARFID, can you maybe share a bit about what drew you to working in the eating disorder space? Was there a personal moment or experience that lit this path for you?
Yeah, well, this is a good question because I feel like I was always interested in therapy, like even like when I was a child, I'm like, oh, I'm going to be a therapist one day. So for me, like, you know, going through school, going through university, like I was always kind of geared towards like mental health stuff. But I feel like eating disorders really started to stand out to me like in young adulthood. You know, I'm human. I'm not immune to the effects of diet culture. I don't think I've really met anyone who hasn't been impacted by it. So it just kind of felt like inevitable that I go in this direction. In university, I actually wrote my thesis on social media and comparison making and like low self-esteem because I was really struggling with those things myself during that time. And I feel like that was like the prime era of Instagram and Facebook when like it was just everywhere and it was huge and like people didn't know maybe that people were manipulating photos or like that it could be
Yeah.
dangerous, you know?
Yep.
Like, you know which
I
era
can
I'm talking about.
relate. Yes, I'm pretty sure we're talking about the same
Yes.
time in university for sure.
Yeah, so I was really interested in that and you know, everywhere that I looked, I felt like all my friends, like everybody was dealing with like this pressure to like look a certain way and to diet. To like fit into like whatever was like big at that time, you know? So it just felt very all consuming. And again, like it was like this inevitable thing. Like this is what's impacting like everyone I love, everyone that I care about, myself. Like, you know, it made sense for me to kind of go more into that. And I haven't looked back since, essentially. Like it's every single piece of mental health work I think is important, but this type of work like resonates on a deeper level for me. And I just feel like it's hard to be a human, and it's hard to be a human in this type of culture, right? I believe that like community and connection is what helps you get through it. So that's essentially just like what I want to do. I just want to spend every day building that community and challenging those norms. There's nothing else I want to do, basically. Yeah.
I love everything that you just said. And everything you said just shines through you as a person, as a clinician, with your clients, with your colleagues. I'm so glad you are at BANA serving our community and impacting lives. So
Thank you.
grateful for that. Absolutely. So to get into the details of ARFID, for someone who's maybe never heard of it, can you tell us a bit more about what it is?
Yeah. So ARFID stands for Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. So it's a big name. And this is just essentially an eating disorder where people tend to eat a very limited range or like amount of food. And it really affects their psychological health and their overall health, basically. But I think an important part to know about ARFID is that it's not really driven by fears about weight or body image. It's more driven by things like strong sensory sensitivities. Certain textures or smells or tastes might feel distressing, or a fear of like negative experiences happening, so like choking, vomiting, diarrhea, GI pain, things like that. Or really just having like no interest in eating. So you don't really have like a huge appetite, you don't get like stomach growls, or like there's not maybe a lot of pleasure in eating. And people who usually have that presentation tend to kind of consider eating like a chore. Just have to do it to survive, and like that's it, basically.
Okay, very interesting that you explain it that way. That third point, having no interest, just to clarify, it's different than someone who may be eating in a chaotic way and their bodies just aren't sending signals because of that disordered eating. It's different from that.
Yeah, but that's also a part of it too, which makes it kind of nuanced, where let's say like you're eating like sporadically, your body might eventually stop sending you signals, right? And that can just decrease the likelihood that you eat even more. Like you might already have very little interest in food, so you don't eat, and then your body's like, well, I'm not gonna waste the energy getting you to eat. Like, we're in survival mode here, right? And then it makes it harder. So it's yes and no, and that can interact with it.
And then for the sensory piece, the way I've heard it explained before is like they don't brittle food or maybe slippery food. Is that an accurate description of that sensory piece?
So it's really different for everybody. So you might love brittle food and you might hate slippery food. Like every single person I've worked with who has like sensory sensitivities, just totally different from one another. So it's good to go in with like no assumptions. I have people who like absolutely love spices and they want like that aroma, and then other people where I need my food to have no sense at all, or I need that crunch, or I don't like it if it's too like rubbery, right? So, like it's very different, I would say, for everybody.
So like with everything, there's a ton of nuance to it.
Pretty
It's
much.
all different from
Yeah.
person to
Nothing
person.
straightforward. No.
Ever, ever. No, that's great. Thank you for explaining that. And it is really important just to say again that there's no body image component in this, which makes it really interesting. Or maybe not no body
Yes.
image,
Like there's
but
a little
less,
bit. Yeah.
maybe less than
Yeah.
other di eating disorder diagnoses. Okay, amazing. Thank you. I feel like we love our acronyms in
We
the eating
do.
disorder space. So thanks for explaining that. How would you, besides maybe the body image piece, how is ARFID different from other eating disorders, would you say?
Yeah, well, I think like the big thing, I guess, would be the motivation behind it. So like there's a lot of like things that could be similar around all eating disorders, but like things like severe food restriction leading to like weight loss or like malnutrition or just like negative impacts on like psychological functioning. Like those things, happen kind of across the board for a lot of folks. But when we think about like the motivation behind the food restriction, like that's the big difference. Where people with like anorexia nervosa or like bulimia nervosa, they might be driven by like a fear of weight gain or like pervasive body image issues, right? Whereas those with ARFID can have negative body image, but that's not really what's impacting the food restriction or like the sole driving force, essentially. So, again, it might be like fear of negative consequences. So they might restrict meals because, they've had a negative experience where they've had like a lot of, vomiting or upset stomach. So now they just won't eat those foods anymore, or discomfort with sensory sensitivities, right? So like not being able to be near foods, or again, like low hunger hormones, right? So it's kind of like that motivation that we're looking at.
That's helpful. We talked about how body image maybe isn't as big of a piece as other eating disorders, but can you maybe describe or explain what those body image issues look like in someone who has diagnosis of ARFID?
Yeah, so again, like every person that I've worked with that has ARFID to some extent has body image concerns because they're humans. Like I said earlier, like I don't think you can really live in this type of culture and not develop some kind of body image concern. Like we're constantly bombarded with like information that we should consider or things that we should dislike about ourselves or change about ourselves. So what we tend to see is that people with ARFID might still struggle with how their body looks. They might still feel self-conscious about like their weight, or like they've internalized those messages. However, that's not, again, driving their restriction. So that's something that comes out kind of in those sessions that you have with them, that it's there. They might still benefit from body image work, might still need to explore it, but it's not really linked one-on-one to like their eating habits essentially. Although I am going to contradict myself again and say that we're in a culture again that tells you there's good food and bad food.
Right.
So like there are people I've worked with where they still might be a little bit nervous about eating certain foods because they think, well, I've been told it's bad. So that is still like another nuance that can kind of pop up.
The work you do and the team at Banna does is very multifaceted. There's so many things. And like what we talk about in with folks in the community is that clients are always confronted with the food every day. We need to eat food, right? Whereas maybe some another substance we may be able to avoid it. So even having that layer of you need to con you're constantly exposed to that makes it much more difficult for sure.
For
Okay, so you
sure.
did talk a little bit about like treatment with folks with ARFID. Can you maybe explain what treatment looks like or how it may differ from treatment of another eating disorder?
Well, so treatment's very individual, like individualized, I mean, and I think, it's important that like I'm sending the message that like we have a framework that we like to work off of, but really what happens in the treatment room, like we're pretty dynamic, we're pretty flexible, like we weave things in like as we know, because people are not going to fit into like a box, right? But we primarily practice with cognitive behavioral therapy for ARFID, so it's called CBTAR. But we do other things too, like dialectical behavioral therapy. We can weave in some like acceptance and commitment therapy here and there. Like we're pretty flexible, but essentially, that type of therapy is really looking at the connection between your thoughts, your feelings, and your behaviors, and how that relates to food and like eating environments. And that might look like exposures, right? Exposures to like specific environmental things, like exposing to like eating around people, or challenging some of those fears around that, or challenging fears of like your predicted outcomes. If I have this food, like I'm going to vomit in an hour because it's going to be so upsetting to my body. So then we'll actually do some exposures around that. It looks like a lot of like food exposures in session too. So we'll have people bring in food and we'll eat food and we'll like kind of look at how it looks, how it smells, how it tastes, and like with the goal of becoming exposed to it and more, like comfortable around certain foods. I guess what's important to say is that this is totally client directed. Like it's not my job to be like, you need to eat steak. You need to eat like this leafy green. Like, if you don't do this, you're not doing treatment right. That's not what we do here. So we're always working at figuring out what does the client want? Like, what do they think would be meaningful for them to achieve? Like, what do they want to see for their life? And then that's what we really focus on, which I think is important. So it's really empowering type of therapy, not a directive therapy where you have like no say. So other things that we might do too, that is like kind of standard across the board, is like challenging some of those diet culture myths that are out there. We would do that with any person because everybody is exposed to it, like regardless of your eating disorder diagnosis. And so that we can do some like pretty experiential stuff too. Like, if there's fears around like vomiting, we might watch like videos of vomiting, or like again, like things that might help it become a little bit less like triggering or interesting to your brain. And we do a lot of interesting things with like interoceptive exposures. So like trying to get people to really get used to like the feelings of bloat or the feeling of like nausea, so they can kind of get through those and like, build up their distress tolerance. Like there's just so many different things that we could do in this type of therapy based off of what you would find the most beneficial.
I think that for someone who personally I have not been through treatment for an eating disorder, or maybe if someone is thinking of seeking help, calling Vienna and seeking support for these types of experiences, I think that's really nice to hear and comforting. Most importantly, that's really client driven, and that there are so many different ways you can take it based on the client's comfort level, but also knowing that the support that you would give is still challenging them in a way to recover, manage.
Manage symptoms or like pursue recovery.
No, that's great. Thanks for explaining that. So you talked about doing CBT for ARFID, and what if someone is concerned that doing CBT for ARFID would be changing their personality or preferences?
So that's definitely something that I've heard before too. And I think it's good to know that like the goal of treatment isn't to change who you are. So really good treatment that I hope that we're doing, like I believe that we're doing, is really trying to honor your identity and help you move toward the kind of life that you want, right? So whether that's like feeling safer around foods or being more flexible or like feeling like, oh, I can go on a vacation now. That was my goal for treatment, to feel comfortable like bringing my safe foods with me like on a trip, right? So, whatever that may be, like our goal isn't to tell you have to like things or like ignore your preferences or pretend that you don't have sensory sensitivities that you've had like your whole life. Those parts of you are valid, and we want to like provide a therapy that's affirming and like neurodiversity like friendly, right? Affirming for that, and really focusing on like a space where like where your lived experience is kind of like the central focus essentially, and supporting you through that.
Just thinking of how might someone explain their experience to a loved one or a family member, or how they need support, like how to ask for support from loved ones in their lives if they do have ARFID or experiencing.
I think that's going to look different context dependent, right? So kind of figuring out like what is it you think you would need that support with. But even with like any eating disorder, like that can look like you advocating for yourself to bring like safe foods to like a family dinner or like a potluck or whatever. And that can look like encouraging your loved ones to seek out resources. Like there's a lot of like parent and caregiver and loved one guides out there. I think your family or your friends, like being empowered and gaining that knowledge is really important for them to know how to support you. So I'm like a big fan of telling your family to go to therapy to talk about this with someone who knows what they're talking about, because I think that that can be really helpful, and to do sessions together if you feel like that would be important. But even like communicating that this isn't like a choice, this isn't free will, like this is something that you're living with, you're trying to kind of work through this, and that you don't necessarily need people to pressure you to eat food or to tell you what you should and shouldn't be eating. So even just putting those kind of like expectations out there is maybe one way to let people know how they can support you. But again, like that's I think independent for each person, and maybe it's just like having your family know that you need to ask you like once a week, like how are you doing? And like that might be enough for you. So it just depends, right?
No, those were great. Thanks for answering that off the cuff like that. Okay, so before we met today, we did put up on Banna socials on Instagram for folks in our community to submit some questions. So we did get two questions. And I'm going to preface this by saying that Banna does support adult clients, although we are the intake for anyone experiencing an eating disorder. Clients at Banna are 18 and over. So the first question was, how do we keep pressure around food low while also helping kids get the nutrients they need? So I think we can expand this to keeping pressure around food low for anyone while trying to get the nutrients.
For sure. Yeah, definitely. So thanks for the disclaimer. Like I work with adults. But so some of the stuff that I say too, like it just might not work for your family, and that's okay as well. But my biggest piece of guidance again is get a therapist, get a dietitian, work with someone so you're not alone throughout this. Especially if you are, caregiving for someone, like it's hard. You have your own stuff going on. Like it's just really difficult to manage life and all the responsibilities, and people can feed off of like your tension and overwhelm as well. So I just think go and get some support to take care of yourself. I think that's huge, right? And knowing your limits too, with what you can handle. That's my like plug for therapy. The second thing I think would be with ARFID, and again, this could kind of go with the earlier question about like how can you help people, like how can you advocate for support for yourself, but is really thinking about how you can increase that sense of like felt safety in the environment. So we know that, our ability to eat, feed ourselves, take care of ourselves can decrease when our nervous system is in threat mode, like when we're feeling overwhelmed and we're shutting down. That is just true for like any person out there, eating disorder or not. Like when we are not doing well, it is hard to take care of ourselves. So really focusing, like, how do you make the environment feel safer? I think is important. And when you think about it, like, in terms of parents, like, parents can set the structure of mealtime, they can offer opportunities, but really it's the child that kind of sets that pace. And the goal really is to support that nourishment and, like, giving those opportunities, but also protecting how the child feels in terms of safety. That's when they tend to make more progress. So, like, making meals calm, avoid coaxing, bribing, pressuring, like, those things can kind of put us in that defense mode, that threat mode, make us feel more anxious. So, like, an example could be just to, like, reduce the expectation and pressure, like, put the meal down and, like, don't focus on it, right? So just offer it, but don't force it. And I say this knowing, like, this is really hard as, like, a caregiver. So, like, please know that I understand that, like, this isn't just so simple. And also too, like, if you are, navigating this and you're trying to change the relationship around food and meal times, knowing too that this is going to take time. So if you have, like, years of, like, a certain, dynamic, it's not going to change within, like, a week or so. And so don't get frustrated if you're not noticing that change, because, like, it does take a long time, I think. But yeah, so a calm environment, being mindful to not make comments about how much they eat or what they eat, like, too many negative comments, because that can really shut down as well. Like, have someone shut down. And then, even kind of considering, like, leaning into safe foods is a really important thing. And I think safe foods, or, like, and foods that typically are safe, we might see are, like, beige foods, like your chicken nuggets, your fries, your potatoes. They get a bad rap in our type of society. But safe foods are really, like, they're not problematic. They're often, like, what helps make sure that they're getting anything at all, which is, important. So if we think again about, like, that nervous system and, like, regulating it, access to safe food, knowing that it's there, can help increase that, like, sense of safety, where over time, like, if they know, like, I have these safe foods, they're reliable, they're there for me, it can increase someone's willingness to, like, explore. Like, having a safe base to go back to means you're more likely to then go out and take a risk, because like, the safety net is still there for you. So yeah, keeping those in the house, and over time, like, you can, like, add some new foods, some, like, maybe more unfamiliar foods with the safe foods. Again, no pressure, but, like, that might over time make it so they're more likely to try that. And something else too is to, like, maybe consider challenging this perspective of, like, what is a balanced meal. So, like, in diet culture, pizza is really, like, demonized, right? But if we break it down, it's just, like, it's a carb, it's a protein, it's a fat, all in one. Like, nice little handy dandy, like, three new big nutrients there. So just remembering too that, like, in these societally demonized foods, like, there are nutrients, like, they are getting things as well. So sometimes I find that helpful to kind of remember. Something else to kind of think about is how you can support sensory needs rather than, like, fighting them, right? So sometimes, people need foods separated, they need, like, specific textures to be considered, or they need, like, a presentation that they feel is predictable and, like, visually, like, satisfying. And knowing too that, like, this is, like, a long-term thing you're working on, so meeting those needs and supporting those needs again is about creating a safe food environment, and that can help with that gradual progress where they feel, ready to maybe explore more challenging things. Or, like, if your kid needs to move around when they eat, or if you need to move around when you eat, like, okay, whatever helps you get that food in right now is a really important thing to consider. And then, celebrating those baby steps, right? Like, with ARFID, with any eating disorder, victories and step forwards sometimes get overlooked and they can seem really small. But even, like, allowing a new food in the room can be huge. Like, that can be a massive milestone for someone. Like, they can now tolerate the sight of a new food, or the smell of a new food, or even touching a new food, not eating it, but just literally touching it. Like, that also could be a huge step forward. So really, really looking for those moments and celebrating them as they happen, because they are actually meaningful. So it's not always just about, like, did they complete the meal, right? And then my last, like, big thing, I guess, is just, like, attuning to your family member, attuning to your loved one, focusing on that emotional t attunement, that validation. Being a safe person for your family member or your loved one is really, I think, what is over time regulating and helps them get to where you all want them to be and where they want to be.
As a parent to little ones myself, that was all very
Yeah.
validating.
Oh, good.
I said a lot of things prior to having kids of what I wouldn't do when they started eating, and that has all gone out the window. Even one of my kids is quite selective, and I can understand a parent's, the pressure. A, you have to sort through your own food rules and relationship with food. And then you have to hear things from outside people, maybe family members on their thoughts, social media and their thought. It's a very overwhelming experience. So I think everything that you just listed was very helpful. Even something as simple as, like you just said, the sight or smell of a new food is a huge win. And I think people need to hear that as a win to be encouraged and to think of the long game. That's how I do it for myself personally, is that okay, they're little now, but you want to develop a healthy relationship with food for life. Yeah. So thank you for sharing that. I think a lot of people, regardless of their age, regardless of who they're caring for, will find that very helpful. So thank you. And then the second question was, where can someone get help for youth under 12 years old with ARFID?
Yeah, that's a big question. And I'm sure there's organizations out there where like they might treat like co-occurring conditions, but from my knowledge, there's not a lot of like free community health clinics that focus on ARFID or concerns with that. So it's I think more about looking for like dietitians, therapists in private or SLPs or like occupational therapists, things like that, unfortunately. 12 and up, though, I know we have a great organization, Windsor Essex Community Health Center. And then, of course, 18 and up, we have BANA. But really, one of like the biggest issues I think our community in particular is facing is just like a lack of understanding, a lack of training, a lack of knowledge. And that is not just to Windsor, that's kind of everywhere. Because ARFID wasn't even recognized as like a formal by itself type of diagnosis until 2013. So there's still a lot of emerging research on it too. And with that means that there's not a lot of community clinics right now that support that. But speaking to your primary care provider is a really great first step because often they will have people at those organizations that have seen ARFID because we know it's out there, we know it's in the community. And that's usually where I recommend people start if you're under 12.
Again, maybe just when someone may have looked online for different resources, and just to know that there is that gap. I know it's not helpful, but at least it's an identified gap that they can then look outside of those community resources. And I always plug NEDIC, so the National Eating Disorder Information Center. If you plug in your postal code, it'll bring up a list of providers in the area. I don't know if you think that would be helpful for people to do. Yeah. So just again, maybe looking for those private,
Like private practice
yes, folks in
clinicians.
private practice, yeah, who can support the kids under 12. Yeah. So a big gap, one that I know leadership at BANA is looking to have conversations about to fill that gap, because it's across all eating disorders, not just ARFID, the gap
For sure.
in care. So
And
whoever submitted this question, you're not the only one. It is a gap.
we've also had community like mapping days where, BANA has met with all the other clinics in the area who are, working in like a frontline capacity. And that's come up like schools, other mental health agencies, like they are noticing like an increase in folks with ARFID and eating disorders in general. But ARFID really was like a big concern, and BANA is actively trying to, help facilitate like training and information, like the dissemination of information so people are able to better assist those who are showing up. So I'm hoping that this won't be like a question that we need to ask in a couple years.
Same. And I know you and other people at BANA are taking a lot more training on ARFID. So hopefully we can just expand our knowledge base to support as many people as possible. Talking about you just we just talked about kids, but oftentimes there is this concern around, they're a picky eater. Are they a picky eater? Do they have ARFID? How do we nav or how do parents navigate that question?
So that's a hard one too, because I work with adults, right, who usually always come to me and say, I was just called a picky eater for like 30 years. Turns out I'm not. And or people who have said, like, my doctor always just told me and my mom that I was extremely picky. So it is like it's a very real question mark for a lot of folks, and there's a lot of nuance again too, so like it's not always straightforward. It makes it complicated, right? But they are very different. So, a picky eater usually does not express like this intense fear as the drive to like their limited eating, right? So pickiness, selective, whatever you want to call it, like is not usually fear driven. So like picky eating is fairly typical, especially in children. There's like lots of evolutionary reasons, and usually people grow out of it with time and exposure to new foods. And picky eaters are really making those choices based on preference, right? And they might not like a certain food or a certain group of foods, but they can still eat like a range of other foods. And while picky eating probably does cause issues at the dinner table, it's not necessarily to the point where it's like impacting their overall psychological functioning, their health, right? We're not seeing like these intense disruptions or major stressors in their life. Although, like, I know it probably feels really intense trying to get your kid to eat, but there is like a difference, right, in the severity. Whereas we think like with ARFID, it's really much more persistent. So people don't grow out of ARFID. It's not like, oh, they became 10 and now they're eating more foods again, right? So it can cause significant anxiety and distress around eating. Again, like you might see children who don't want even certain foods to be in their vicinity because it's so distressing. Like that wouldn't be picky eating, right? People with ARFID avoid entire categories of food, or they might struggle to just eat in general. And there could be food available to them, and they'll still choose not to eat, right? So these eating patterns can interfere with like their daily life. Like they might not be able to socialize with friends or go to school or attend certain events because they're so overwhelmed by it. So like that's a key difference, right? Is that picky eaters will still want to eat the foods they like. Whereas you might notice with some kids with ARFID, they just don't want to eat at all. And they might experience that like anxiety around it, right? And it might make it very, very difficult for them. So some other things to maybe kind of consider would be, some kids with ARFID or people with ARFID might say, like, I'm just not hungry. I'm never hungry. They might literally never think about food. They might forget to eat for like 12 hours, right? Because it's not a priority. Whereas in contrast, picky eaters will be motivated to eat. They will want to eat the food that they enjoy. So we don't see the same like lack of interest. Or, someone with ARFID who maybe has fear of like negative experiences, they, might have had a scary experience with food, like maybe they choked or something. And then they might feel unable to eat solid foods for like a really long time after that. So again, like that's more than ordinary picky eating.
That makes sense. We do get that question quite a lot in the community at health fairs or info booths, things like that. So I know that'll answer some people's questions. So what are some warning signs that people might look out for, either in themselves or a loved one, for ARFID?
Yeah, for sure. So these, there's a lot of different things that would maybe warrant you to just kind of explore with your primary care provider or like, speak to someone. But, if you're noticing like extreme negative reactions when like unpreferred foods are around or when they're offered to you, like that would be maybe a warning sign. Avoidance of certain textures, colors, scents, things like that, where it's like, I can't have anything that's red. That might be a warning sign. Becoming like just like agitated around the presence of a certain kind of food. That would also be like another thing to maybe look closer into. Or like avoiding an entire food group, that would be a cause for concern. Some other things that might, that you might be already like tracking is if, especially if it's a child, but this is the same for adults too, but like failure to gain weight or failure to like maintain weight, right? Like a lot of weight loss, nutritional deficiencies. If you notice like gagging during meals or like not being able to maybe tolerate like the presence of food on your hands, right? Again, this overlaps with like a whole bunch of other things that could happen in life.
Right.
So it's not for sure like, oh, this is ARFID, but those are things like in conjunction with other warning signs, like could be something for you to look at. Or if you notice that your child is dropping their safe foods. So for example, you could have pancakes and they love pancakes and they're eating it. And then all of a sudden, like they can't eat it anymore. They're refusing to have pancakes. So now they just lost like another food that they were eating.
Right.
And so if you notice that kind of pattern where like, every so often they just like drop a food and will not eat it again. So over time they're eating less and less variety. Generally, like just your child or you even expressing just a fear of like vomiting or choking or physical concerns when you're eating. So if every time you eat, you're worried about like IBS symptoms, like that could also be a warning sign.
Okay, those are really helpful. And I always think it's just better to talk to your primary care provider than not. Like if you have any
Yeah.
concern at all for yourself or another person, loved one, it's always better to just have that conversation and put it on the radar, make a note of it
Sure.
in the file, and at least you've explored it, right?
Yeah, like when in doubt, right? Reach out to someone who could help you navigate that.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for sharing those. And I'm always curious in these conversations, is there a story or specific instance where either like yourself or, at BANA talking to colleagues has helped someone in particular with ARFID that's really stood out to you?
Yeah. I feel like every person I've worked with has stood out to me. And maybe that's like an easy way out of this answer, but I feel this way about every single thing I do at BANA. Like every single interaction I've had, like it feels so transformative and like genuinely life-changing when I see people through treatment. So when I think about like ARFID specifically, I've seen people really leave feeling like they can be active participants in their life, which to me
That's
is like
nice.
the biggest thing, right? And
Yeah.
like that might look like, again, like I can go on a trip now. I can travel. Like I don't have to stay at home all the time, right? Or I can go out and I can, go out to like a new restaurant with my friends and I don't have to like miss out on these social opportunities because I'm not so anxious about it anymore. Or, I've had people like really work hard on like setting boundaries and normalizing their needs. So the people who leave and they're like, you know what? Like, I don't feel like there's something wrong with me. I feel like I deserve to be respected. I deserve to have like food preferences respected and honored. And like that is huge. And I always find that to be really, really significant because I work with adults and often the people who are coming to me are people who have gone like decades of feeling pathologized, right? Decades of feeling like there's something inherently wrong with them. And to see people get to a point where they feel that compassion for themselves, they feel that acceptance, and like that sense that things make sense now and that there's nothing wrong with them, like they're valid as they are, like that's always so impactful for me. And that always makes me feel like really, really, I guess, passionate again about this work. Yeah. So that's my goal, I guess, for everybody that I work with. And I really hope that that's what people get when they leave BANA.
BANA has changed lives with so many people. I know I'm biased, but the work that everyone does, the whole team
Yeah.
really comes together to change people's lives. And folks always say, when we're out in the community, having an eating disorder may not apply to every single person, obviously, but body image issues, someone's
Yeah.
relationship with food, that applies to everyone. I think
Yeah.
it's inevitable in our society to
Yeah.
not have maybe days or periods of times where, we may be struggling with our thoughts
Yeah.
and feelings about what we look like. So
For sure.
the work that you're doing with clients and beyond is so impactful.
Well, thank you. Because I agree. Like, I think we're in a culture that really benefits from you being disconnected from your body
Yes,
and
yeah.
disembodied, right? Like not attuned. And
Yep.
so that's why, again, like I don't know if it's cheesy, but it's like this is just the most important work in the world to me because it's like the idea that, people can start to foster that attunement to themselves, that acceptance to themselves. Like this is your vessel, this is what you're in, day in, day out. Like it's just so important and so crucial.
Yeah, I often wonder, what would people do with all the time they would get back if they weren't so concerned about what they look like, the foods that they were eating, like how much brain space, myself included, we would all get
I
back
know.
from not thinking about it all the time. So
Well, that's the
just
thing, like
one.
diet culture has robbed us of that, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm gonna have you back on another episode maybe to talk about diet culture, because I'm sure we could talk about that all day. Okay, so one of my last questions, what is BANA specifically doing, like as a clinical team, to stay up to date with information about ARFID? What does that look like?
So we do things all the time. BANA is such a, again, I'm biased, but great agency because really prioritize like this continuing education. Like we are always learning, and I'm here talking about ARFID, and I don't know everything about ARFID, and that's an important thing to kind of recognize is that I have to keep growing and learning as well. So BANA is really serious about ongoing training. So whether that's like we recently had everyone trained through Boston Mass General Hospital. So that one is really great because we had the developers of CBT-AR training us.
Wow.
So that one was great. There's also been a bunch of lived experience training, so where we've had the opportunity to learn from people with ARFID, with other sensory sensitivities or autistic folks, people who are able to tell us like what it's like, from their experience. And some of these people also happen to be dietitians. Like that's been really interesting too, to get like a really great insight into like what can we do as an organization. So we're always looking for information and opportunities and research, and we're connected to, other organizations across Ontario like CHEO, who are working, on the front lines, but also who are producing significant amounts of research about ARFID. And then learning from community partners too, and like collaborating with like OTs and SLPs and people who can give us valuable information as well. So we're doing a lot. We attend conferences all the time, and we hope to kind of keep doing that so we can keep on top of it, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is nice to work for an organization who values that. So it really helps, everyone, clients especially, get the support that they need. Okay, so if our listeners could only take away three simple facts about ARFID, what would they be?
So I think maybe the first thing is that ARFID is not the same as picky eating. That's huge. ARFID affects people of all ages. So again, like people tend to just look for children, but I work only with adults, right? So ARFID is across the lifespan. And I think the last thing is that, ARFID is not a matter of willpower. You can't just tell someone to try harder, eat more food, like just do it. That is not how it works. So I think those are like the big things that people should remember.
Those are great. I love them. Three simple takeaways. Great. And then where can our listeners find more information about ARFID?
So I think you kind of plugged Netic already.
Yes.
That's a great one. BANA's website has some information as well. You can always reach out to our health promotion team too. But really, Netic, I think, is a great resource. They're trusted. Everything they say is backed up by evidence and legit. So that's where I would kind of direct most people to go.
Yeah, absolutely. Always a shout out to Ari and the team at Netic because for the incredible work that they do. And last question for you, Heather. Okay. What are your final words of wisdom that or a message you would share with someone who's listening that either has ARFID, like a diagnosis, or thinks that they may have ARFID?
For sure. Okay, so if you're listening to this and you're encountering this, what I would like to say is that your experiences are real and they are valid, and there is nothing inherently wrong with you, right? You're deserving of support and strategies that honor who you are and help you feel safe and comfortable with food. And I would say don't give up. Please don't give up, right? It's absolutely possible to live a full and rich and meaningful life with ARFID. And we are here to help you if you ever want that, right? And if you ever want to connect with us.
Thank you. And as always, our 1-855 number, Alicia, our wonderful intake worker, can also support with any questions that folks might have as well. So thank you so much, Heather. I have loved this conversation. I'm
Aw.
so grateful that you agreed to sit down with me
It's
and chat. It's always a
been fun.
pleasure. Yeah, I know. We'll do it again for sure.
Yeah,
And so I know so many people in the community will find this conversation helpful. But if you are listening and you're interested in learning more about eating disorder services in Windsor, Essex, please find us, Banna, on our socials at Banna Windsor, our website, banna.ca, or read more in the Banna Be Yourself magazine, where I'm actually going to plug Heather again. She's been doing a multi-part series on the history of body image, which is an incredible read. So make sure you read that from our website. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.